You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a wonderfully cloudy, it rained yesterday. What a gorgeous 70-degree weather.
People are definitely in the fall mood all of a sudden. Ordinarily, we kind of taper off from September through the middle of October towards the later part of the month. And then we get that first storm that makes everybody go, oh, fall is here. Are your bulbs in yet? Do you have any native plants? It's time to plant broccoli, isn't it? We're getting all that right now because temperatures have cooled dramatically. We actually did get a little tiny bit of rain out of this storm that is passing over us. They got more over in wine country, pulling up my usual resource of the California-Nevada River forecast area. Just trips off the tongue, doesn't it? Website run by NOAA, which gives you information, all the information and data you could possibly want, and also very cool graphic versions of all those things about how much rainfall we got, how much is predicted, all that sort of thing. And looking at the last 24 hours, we got maybe 1/100th of an inch in Davis. I would say on my property here, 1/10th of an inch, enough to, as I say, coagulate the dust from the tree and drop it onto my windshield.
Spot it with a couple of little splats so it turns into mud.
Right. So it's not enough to take it off of the windshield. So my highly scientific measure is that that's about 1/10th of an inch of rainfall, probably.
Well, then we got 1/10th of an inch twice.
It could be. Yeah, something like that. I need another 1/10th of an inch to clean off the windshield. They did get 1/3 of an inch, 1/4 of an inch in some of the areas in the wine country. San Rafael, I see, is 1/4 inch. This was not a substantial rainstorm, but it covered a big area. People were certainly happy to see cooler conditions. Temperatures today, let's see, what is our temperature going to be for this coming week? Lois and I are doing this, recording this on October 1 for broadcast on October 2, 2025. Right now it's 61 degrees and overcast, which is not something we say very much over, have said very much over the last few weeks. Chance of showers tonight, 59 degrees. Thursday, 74 degrees, slight chance of showers, then becoming sunny later in the day. Partly cloudy Thursday night, 54 degrees. Friday will be 76 degrees and sunny. Oh, that sounds nice. Friday night will be 54 degrees and clear. And then we have a warming trend on Saturday all the way up to 81. And then Saturday night, 54, clear both days. Sunny on Sunday at 79. Sunday night, mostly clear with a low around 54. Monday, sunny, 79. Tuesday, sunny, 80. Nights in the mid-50s. Great planting weather for all kinds of things. We're at the beginning of a very active gardening period in the Sacramento Valley and all parts of interior California, where people are throwing out grass seed to make their lawns thicker, putting wildflower seed in bare areas because they want to get those poppies off to a good start, cutting back some of the overgrown stuff in their summer garden to make room for their winter vegetables, planting those cool season, as we call them, winter vegetables. Lots of those going in right now and plenty in every garden center and hardware store in the area. You can find whatever you're after more than likely in the next week or so. All kinds of stuff going on right now. It's a great time to plant trees, but I would remind you that this has been a very brief rainstorm, and we're not going to be raining much more, at least within the next week or so. So if you do those things that we just talked about, you will need to water those plants. Okay, the watering season is not over. We didn't get enough rainfall to significantly hydrate the soil really at all. What it did do was soften the surface a little bit. So you should be able to scatter seeds, and it might be easier to dig some of those planting holes. You'll still need to pre-soak for larger plants. You'll still need to water things in and keep a close watch on the watering, because we can get very warm, very windy, all through September, all through October into early November. It doesn't always happen, but we typically have a high wind episode at some point in the month of October here. Pattern usually is a north wind with a very low humidity, very dry conditions. So you're practically back to summertime irrigation. It's great weather for planting and doing stuff, but that doesn't mean that the irrigation season is over. It's our fundraising week here at KDRT. So instead of all those announcements we usually do, we're just going to say, please give us money.
Well, you know, the way they set this up, this fundraising thing, because we have a lot of folks around here who produce shows, many of whom produce shows in the studio. So they go in front of the mics and they're doing their thing. And what they do is they partner up a couple of different shows, and the one is doing their show and somebody else walks in and goes, oh, hi, how are you doing? And talks. So, hello, Don. I know you're on the Davis Garden Show right now, but I'm Lois Richter. I'm from That's Life. And I wanted to say how much I enjoy your show. And to your listeners, give us money.
There you go. Please don't forget to say please, or you can give us please. A car if you want to. So I actually just went over to the schedule guide at kdrt.org. I love to do this each year when we have these fundraising appeals, and I count at least 34 locally produced shows. Locally produced meaning some volunteer like me or Lois, and there's a bunch of others, are doing music and public affairs shows, and the overwhelming majority are music shows, but there are some outstanding public affairs shows as well. By the way, this show is in that category. We're public affairs, just so you know. But just in the music, there's doo-wop, jug band, a whole show of jug band. Jazz, I do that one. There's a show of Hawaiian music that's been on KDRT for years. World music, folk, gospel, cowboy music and poetry. One that's just acoustic guitar and strings. Classical show and third streaming, which is sort of the synthesis of jazz and classics. There's one show where he brings musicians into the studio, interviews them, and they play right there in the studio. And one of my favorites is there's a long-running show dedicated to the music and artists of the Grateful Dead. That's all here on KDRT, and that's just part of what's out there. There's so much more, all kinds of wonderful public affairs programming as well. I don't know anywhere else you're going to find that kind, that range of programming, except on local community radio, supported by listeners like you and me. So if you want to join us in celebrating KDRT's 21st birthday, go to kdrt.org/donate, and you'll find all kinds of options. If there's even a new T-shirt, celebrating 21st birthday. Thank you all for contributing. Thanks for all the notes you send us with garden questions all the time. Thanks for the comments that we get from you. And as always, thanks for listening. All right, lots to be done in the garden right now. We have lots of conversations to have. I have a number of questions we get to this time of year. And sometimes they're challenging ones, tough ones. Sometimes they're easy ones. Some of them take more explanation than others. I think we have them lined up in order of complexity. Is that correct?
Oh, I'm not sure about order of complexity, but I got to tell you, this first one has me stumped. This is says, Kenneth writes, with variable size of early girl tomatoes. Yeah. Mm. Hi, Don and Lois. For some reason, my early girl tomatoes produce different sized tomatoes. One plant has normal sized tomatoes, and one adjacent to it were very small. They all use the same organic fertilizers, and I don't do any trimming. The dried out plants are at the end of their life. It was just meant to show you the size of the tomatoes. Yeah. When I buy the plants, can I assume that all early girl plant tomatoes are VNFT? Or do I have to make sure they're labeled as such? Thanks again for all your great advice. Now, Ken is in Palo Alto.
So
lovely pictures, by the way.
No, you cannot assume that they're all VFNT. Tomato early girl does not have nematode tolerance, to my knowledge, and is not resistant to tobacco mosaic virus, at least not the original form of it. So as far as I can recall, early girl was always just VF, verticillium resistant and resistant to the first strain of Fusarium. Upon looking it up, I do see that there is enhanced resistance to Fusarium. There are now three strains of Fusarium wilt out there, two of which many hybrids have resistance to. Early Girl is an F1 hybrid. The F1 hybrid line has been maintained since the 1970s. So there is the issue, interestingly, of perhaps degradation of the seed lines over time. You know, in order to maintain an F1 hybrid, you have to maintain two perfectly maintained parent lines and keep hybridizing them. I'm going through this quickly, but an F1 hybrid is created by making the same hybrid cross over and over by hand. So you take the one parent and the other parent, you cross them, and you save the seed from that. And you have to do that mechanically each time. And then you get the F1 progeny, which will have the desirable characteristics. Whoever is doing that needs to maintain those parent lines very stable. For many years, that was Seminus Seeds here in the Davis area. Interesting. Woodland area was the owner of Early Girl. Seminus, 15 plus years ago, got purchased by Monsanto, which caused a big flurry in the early days of social media and the internet because people thought Monsanto was going to do something with it. Well, they did. They kept selling the seed. That's what they did with it. It was a very profitable product line. Seminus was a company that introduced a lot of the well-known garden hybrids, including Early Girl, Black Beauty, Eggplant, some of the others. Now these were part of the ownership of Monsanto, which we had to talk with people about a great deal at the time. There was a real concern that they were either going to take them off the market or manipulate them somehow. No, Monsanto is a big agricultural seed company and has always had a conventional product line as well as their genetically modified product line. This was just a way of them expanding into a different part of the market. They did not change it. The F1 hybrid is still maintained, but over 50 plus years, you can imagine that it might change the, you know, the parent lines perhaps were not maintained perfectly. I don't know. The point is that smaller fruit on a tomato plant than normal is often a sign that it was stressed at some time during the development of the fruit. In the fruit expansion phase of tomatoes, and this is especially true of peppers, by the way, they set, and then there's a period of cell division when it doesn't look like anything's happened, several days, a week or two, and then the fruit starts to expand. And in the fruit expansion phase, if something stresses the plant, a sudden drought stress being the most common that we encounter here, particularly if you're in a raised planter where a sudden drought stress can be really sudden and really severe, the fruit will stop expanding and simply ripen at that size. Still usable, still perfectly good, but smaller than you would expect. And this happens on the same plant sometimes. You get different phases of development. Fruit got to full size and the one behind it is not fully expanded and you have a sudden drought stress. Well, the big one will just continue to ripen. The smaller one will stop expanding and ripen. So you sometimes see variable size, of course, right on the same plant. If there's a lot more fruit on one particular plant, then it probably just doesn't have the oomph to develop them all to full size. So that's another possibility. It is possible that you had a mislabeled plant. That's more common in our industry than you might think. And it's funny how we all look at other possibilities, and nurseries, of course, are never going to leap to this possibility. But Occam's razor tells me, in most cases, you had a labeling problem on your plant more than
that. That was my first thought. Look like the same plant, but and it's hard to tell because they're at the end of their life, but the leaves look a little different, don't they?
Hard to say, and leaf variability on plants is, well, it's considerable, let's put it that way, even from one plant to the next. There'd be no real way to tell. Shady Lady is a variety I grow every so often, every few years. Last couple of years I've grown at the plants have done very poorly. I have to assume that the whoever is maintaining that seed line just isn't doing a good job of it, but it's also possible they're just mislabeled. We had a big problem with mislabeling in the industry about 3 years ago. We called it jalapeno gate at the time because it was affecting pepper plants. People were planting jalapenos and getting bell peppers. Okay, that's all right. Not so great the other way around. There was a whole lot of mix-ups right post-COVID in the seed industry. And people were just, you know, I planted my favorite chef's choice orange tomato and it grew and set fruit and it was a little round 6 ounce red tomato. It clearly wasn't chef's choice orange. So that was a major labeling problem. It got a lot of discussion in the nursery industry at the time. So my best guess is that what you're dealing with there is a mislabeling issue. But when you have a variety that's been around for a long time, there are possibilities of degradation of the seed lines. I just have to say that that's certainly possible. More likely, problem in the nursery.
So if it was mislabeled, you might be able to tell a difference in taste.
Could be, yeah.
Early is that true?
You could if you have a sophisticated palate, yes. Most of us can't really taste a big difference between similar tomatoes. I honestly have enormous respect for tomato breeders because essentially a tomato flavor is a balance of acidity and sweetness, and that's what you're comparing from one to another. But there are other flavor constituents, and some of these folks, let's take the process, for example, that was done a number of years ago when Monsanto purchased Seminus. some folks decided, all right, we're going to take Early Girl and we're going to grow it out and make it an open pollinated tomato, which you can do quite easily. You can grow it, you can grow the seed, and a bunch of that will grow into tomatoes that are not at all like your Early Girl, but some of them will be like your Early Girl. That's a pretty sophisticated analysis to do, to take a 5 or 6 ounce fruit and say, yep, this tastes just like it's supposed to, when, you know, a lot of ripe tomatoes, honestly, to you or me, taste pretty much the same. So I have to say, I have an enormous admiration for people who are able to make those fine levels of distinction between seedling tomatoes. But they did so. They did successfully grow out Early Girl because of this big concern that something might happen to the variety. And they decided to call that Dirty Girl. Took 5 or 6 generations. You grow all the seedlings, you rogue out the ones that aren't like Early Girl and throw them out. You take the seeds of the ones that were. You do the same thing. You got to have room for like 100 tomato plants a year in order to do this, or more. And then you just do that for several years until 99% of the fruit that comes off is, to a sophisticated palate and to a good analyst, indistinguishable from the Early Girl you started with. And now you have an open pollinated version of what was previously a hybrid that has been done. And you'll find those out there. Dirty Girl is the one, is the name that they went and put on that.
Is that legal?
Yeah. In fact, someone contacted Monsanto at the time because the question was whether they had some, some proprietary, like, was it a patent or even a trademark on the name? Wow. No, they acquired it with Seminus. In fact, I remember the spokeswoman for Monsanto at the time saying, "We're just happy people like Early Girl tomatoes. we have no control over it. If it had been a patent, that would have expired long ago." And as far as they were concerned, go for it. You know, if you want to do that. And yes, you can. There's nothing illegal about growing out a hybrid into an open pollinated string. It's not the same tomato. It's so close that you and I wouldn't be able to distinguish it, but it's not the same tomato. And in our 6 ounce round red tomato, you know, there's a lot of them out there. It would be hard to tell apart. But Early Girl has this reputation in California as being the best tasting tomato. So it's still very, very, very popular.
So Ken added an addendum to his Early Girl question. He said, "I forgot to mention that I did check the stems to see if there are any signs of diseases, and they all looked healthy. Each plant was watered the same when the leaves were wilted only in the morning. Interesting to know is that my tomato plants usually are vibrant until the end of October, but they all seem to die off in the middle or end of September this year."
Well, that's almost certainly an irrigation distribution issue. And well, I'm being a little lazy in saying that because this has been the conversation I've had with people all summer long. It was unusual this year. I mean, and he's in Palo Alto, so same rainfall pattern basically that we had, which was last measurable rainfall was in March, well, April, but March was the last one that made any significant difference. We went into the planting season for vegetables with the soil dry. And of course, we had conversations all season long here on the radio and in my nursery about the need for deeper irrigation. But many of the conversations were about the distribution of irrigation. And this year, you know, with a long dry season and a raised planter, my guess is that you need to check the distribution of your emitters. I assume you're using drip irrigation on there. And a conversation I had with someone just a week ago showing me his tomatoes, and you know, the amount of water he was putting on them seemed right. Just like I had with one of my water lines. In my case, the emitters had plugged. I hadn't flushed the line out, and several on 6 of my plants. It was a great experiment I didn't intend to do on 6 of my plants. They plugged to the point that the water for those plants was way lower than it should have been. And it took me about 10 days to figure that out because I was doing other things. And I suddenly realized, boy, those plants, no new growth coming. They're not growing real well. Something's going wrong. And these emitters aren't working at all. And I had to not only flush out the line because I'm on a well with hard water with a lot of salts in it. I had to add new emitters. And I went ahead and hand watered those plants. They all recovered very quickly. But what I have is a very long line of drip for each bed. And it's just one long line. It's 8 feet over to the next line. I mean, I have a huge vegetable garden, so I have a big path in between. I would run that this year 10, 20, 30% longer than I normally should have had to based on plant performance and plant calculated water use. And still, I'd go 2 feet out from the plant in towards the path, and it's bone dry. absolutely bone dry. All I was watering was right at the base of the plant. And in some cases, as I got further down on the line where I had had this problem with the emitters, I went ahead and just started hand watering those plants to augment the drip. And immediately they started flushing on new growth. So one of the simplest diagnostics you can do for a plant that is not growing as much as you get to the mid late part of the season to determine whether it's drought related is widen your water distribution. I could have put in a second drip line further out, but I just had a hose. So I just went ahead and gave each plant a good deep soaking as if it was a little young tree. And I washed them off at the same time, good opportunity to do that. And they all flushed on new growth. So I just continued adding water by hand above and beyond what the drip line had been doing for those poor six plants that I had tortured early in the season. They recovered, they grew, they're flowering, they're set, they're even going to have more fruit in about 2 or 3 weeks. So it did solve the problem. More to the point, it was an easy diagnostic and an easy outcome. Hey, they started growing when I gave them a wider circle of watering. I think most of you would do better if you had a basin around each plant as if it were a little tree that you could fill with water. Yes, you can use drip. I rely on it completely on my farm, but you may need to either add more emitters to fill up that basin, or every now and then, it's a good idea to wash the plants off anyway, take a hose out there, rinse them off, set it down, and really give them a long soaking. And when I would let it soak for at a slow flow for a couple of hours, very 10 days or something like every 10 days or something like that, those plants would immediately start to grow again. So distribution of water seems to have been a problem for a lot of people in our area. It's a real problem in raised planters. And my guess, without seeing anything else about your property, is that you had an issue with distribution between the two plants. The plant on the edge of the bed probably didn't have anything to tap into compared to the plant in the middle of the bed. Tomato roots want to go deep. If they can't, they'll go out if they possibly can. And the less deep they go, the more you'll have to provide everything they need. Your soils vary. There's people listening with soils that are very deep and fertile, like mine and like Lois's. And there's people who have a foot of topsoil sitting on top of bedrock. So how you're going to water is going to differ depending on what soil you're working with. But in most cases here, I was finding it was a distribution issue. They talk about running it for a couple hours and still they were having problems. So we'll take a trowel and just start going out from the plant. A foot out, 2 feet out, and see how far out the moisture is going. And you just don't, we just weren't getting the distribution that we needed this year in many cases. That's my best guess about what you're dealing with there. It shouldn't be browning off that much unless you have something like the russet mite that we talked about before with another listener or some problem like that. But more likely, when I see browning like that, it's typically related to insufficient irrigation. And of course, that would really catch up with you at the end of the season. Hope that helps.
So Don, which raspberries do well here?
Oh, I wish I could just say a particular variety and leave it at that.
I just say none.
Well, that is pretty much my answer on this. I've grown all kinds of raspberries. I mean, I've tried every possible variety I can think of, and none of them have done well for me. So it's very frustrating. They grow great, by the way. They grow fine. That's not the issue. I've planted all the well-known ones in the area. I've done them in sun. I've done them in shade. I've done them in containers and so forth. My experience with raspberries is that they grow vigorously. They spread freely, the plants will flower, and then the fruit doesn't develop well because of our high temperatures at the time they would be ripening. Typically, raspberries ripen here in May to June, and we're getting hot. We get into the 90s or even the upper 80s, and the fruit just doesn't develop properly. I have tried several varieties and have yet to find one that yields well for me in spite of good growth on the plant. And as I said, I've tried them in partial shade. I've tried them in full sun. None of that has made any difference. So as a retailer, I could just stick them out there and let people buy them and have those experiences themselves, but I prefer not to do that. However, if they go online to ucanr.edu or other sites like that, Master Gardeners, blogs, and so forth, pretty high likelihood they're going to mention certain varieties. Heritage is probably the most widely planted, most commonly sold variety of raspberry because it is considered widely adaptable. Those of you listening in places that are not quite as hot and dry as we are here will probably do well with Heritage. That's just one that seems to do well pretty much everywhere, except in the valley.
Except it is.
So they always mention these two varieties that I swear have been carried forward from one extension publication to another for at least 60 years now.
But don't exist anymore.
Well, they must exist somewhere, but not in the nursery trade. Oregon 1030 and Baba Berry are mentioned in UC Extension publications. I know because people still come in and ask for them, and I have still found them listed as being heat tolerant. Baba Berry was introduced when we opened in the 1980s, and so we bought them, and we sold them, and we grew them. I found they did not yield well. The fruit was that kind of dry, crumbly style of raspberry, not the juicy, sweet style of raspberry. So they weren't that great anyway. More to the point, they quickly developed a serious labeling problem with Baba Berry, a nursery industry issue. It fell out of the trade. A few years later, it came back, and I'm thinking, there were some imposters being sold under this name in the past. Wonder what the source of these was, and I don't know. But neither variety, in my experience, is available in the nursery trade at all. So going to nurseries, looking online, trying to find Oregon 1030 or Baba Berry is not likely to be very successful. It's going to be a wild goose chase, as we say. So,
is there anything that people can grow that's close to a raspberry?
Yeah, the Tayberry. Tayberry is a blackberry-raspberry hybrid that was created years ago. The same hybrid cross created two distinct berries. The Tayberry, which resembles a raspberry, and the Loganberry, which resembles a blackberry. And they are the same parent. So getting to that hybridization question of different outcomes, they're very different. Tayberry has the sweet, milder flavor of a raspberry. It is a little bit drier texture, and the Loganberry is a lot more like a boysenberry or like a blackberry, sort of in between those two. So yes, there is, and it's out there. You'll find it in the trade in the bare root season. There's never been an abundance of Tayberries, but they do exist, and they're one that will grow here. And I urge you to experiment. I would suggest, based on my own experience, that you'll be happier if you do them in a large container, just because once you find that it isn't working for you, it'll make it easier to abandon the project than if you put them in the ground
and root
somewhere.
Them out is what you're trying to say.
Easier to get rid of them if you decide you're no longer going to explore this project. And whenever I say this, I mean, this came up on Nextdoor recently in the Facebook group and all that kind of thing. Someone typically comes in and says, oh, I've done really well with raspberries, which I'd like to know which variety they were, and they usually don't know. So my comment then is, well, perhaps you could share some of those with people who are looking for a well-performing raspberry variety for this area.
And then you find out that they really live in Michigan.
Or their definition of does really well might be different than yours and mine. That's something I do encounter. You know, having a fruit or two isn't really, to me, what we're after. I'm like, are we getting bowls of fruit? Is it worth all of this effort?
I want a pie. Every time I go out and pick berries, yeah. I want a pie.
You're not going to get that with
raspberries. 2.5 cups.
Yeah. Now, so the next question someone asked was, well, what berries do well here? Almost all the others. Almost all the other cane berries. You know, blackberries, boysenberries, all do very well here. In fact, your biggest issue with those typically is simply confining them. They will not only spread at the ground level by short rhizomes, but they'll arch over, touch the ground, and root. And on my property, you can find the 3 or 4 different places that I planted cane berries at one time or another. They're still there, having
it's
spread.
A great cover in your area. The birds, I'm sure, love it.
Oh, yes.
The foxes do too.
Oh yeah, the foxes, everybody. It's great cover, but that's not necessarily what people are looking for their backyard. If you want wildlife habitat, yeah, caneberries are a great way to get it. I do suggest, though, that you do something so you can stake them up off the ground, that you putting them on a fence is good if you can go to the backside of that fence and see what they're doing, like into your neighbor's yard. And they do annually need to have some renewal pruning done. The thing to remember with all of these berries is that they mostly grow 1 year, flower and fruit on that cane the next year, then they're done. That cane never fruits again. While it's fruiting, new ones are coming up for the following year. So you go out after a cane, long arching shoot, really easy to see, has finished fruiting. You can do it right when they finish, prune that all the way to the ground. You can see the new ones coming up that you're then going to tie up onto your structure. And those will be what gives you fruit the following year. There is some confusion on that because there are some types that will fruit the first year. And these have actually become a pretty big deal in the blackberry industry, the primocane. I like to call them primocane for California, primocane berries, which will fruit on the first year's growth. Then that same cane fruits again the second year, then it's done. So those are great. Prime Arc is a good example. Prime is usually part of the name that came out of the University of Arkansas. And they're bred actually for cold climates. If you're in Canada, apparently, they don't live through to a second year or something. I'm not quite sure how it works, but they get fruit on the first year's growth. So that was important. But home gardeners thought this was great. And there are some really good quality ones. And there's a thornless Prime Arc blackberry out there. So that one will fruit the first year. The most successful planting we ever did in a small space with blackberries was when I took a big old box, 4x4 box, it was 2 feet deep, filled it with a mix of native soil and compost, and planted 4 berries in it, and put a stake on each one that was very securely in the ground. As they grew, I tied them up the stake. So there were 4 plants in a 4x4 box, and they got watered with the vegetable garden. And they would try and escape routinely. They would try and arch over and land on the ground. I'd cut them off. And they were expanding in the box, but that was in the box, so that was manageable. For about 4 or 5 years, they stayed confined in the box. They gave huge amounts of berries in a 4x4 area. As long as I kept after them, they didn't escape and take over the yard. And then about the 5th year in...
You missed, didn't
no,
you?
No, they started going out the bottom of the box. So that meant the rhizomes had expanded out, and now I was going to have a problem on my hands. So we dismantled the whole thing and got rid of it. But for 4 or 5 years, we had more berries than we knew what to do with in about a 4x4 area.
So livestock trough is your solution.
Livestock, they're
going to go out the bottom, are they?
Correct. I've used a livestock trough and that works very well. The only problem I had there was it was against a fence. They went up the fence. I tied them on the fence. That was all fine. But they also fell down on the backside of the fence and they rooted within the same season. So it's important to know they can get away from you. But berries are very easy to grow. The key thing I have found growing berries over the years, plenty of water early in the season. That is to say, well, they're flowering, well, the fruit is developing, and until you harvest, which is usually May, June, early July, depending on the variety. At that point, they're surprisingly drought tolerant. You'll see berries. I've got some on my property right along the freeway. I'm certainly not watering them, and they're doing fine. And of course, in rainier climates, they're invasive as all get out. But they do need good irrigation as the fruit is developing, or else you could have problems with just the fruit not developing fully. They're still edible, but you wouldn't have the quality that's there. Another thing to be aware of, if you have a cherry tree, the spotted-winged Drosophila likes berries just as much as it likes cherries, but it likes red berries. It doesn't go to blackberries unless there's a high population pressure. In managing the spotted-winged Drosophila in cherry country, managing berries is a big part of it because those tend to be places where berries are all over the place. And they'll tell them, get rid of all these, you know, just get them all off your farm or ranch or whatever. They're much more attracted to red fruit, like a regular cherry or a raspberry, than they are to dark purple or black fruit like a blackberry. I've never had spotted winged Drosophila on my blackberries, and I did have them in my cherries elsewhere on the property. But if you have a cherry tree and you're not doing anything about it, and you've got the spotted winged Drosophila in the fruit, they could, under high population pressures, move into your berries. Remember that this is an insect that has a very fixed upper temperature range. It only infests in our area fruit in through the month of May. If you get into the mid-80s, they essentially are sterilized by high temperatures. So in our area, it's a problem with raspberries. That was the first crop it was found on in California, and cherries. It doesn't typically go on to blackberries. But if we have a cool spring or a cool early summer, really, and you have a heavy crop on your nearby cherry tree or your neighbor has a cherry tree and there's fruit rotting on the ground, there's clouds of these spotted-winged Drosophila, they will get into your berries. If you think that's possible, real easy, pick them. Put them in a bowl, fill the bowl with water, and wait. They will float to the surface and you'll know whether your fruit was infested. You may not want to do that. But be aware of the fact that it can be a host to this particular pest.
Okay, so let's talk next about soil in planting hole. Okay, so this person lives in South Davis, so this is a local situation.
Yeah.
I have several 2 foot by 2 foot by 2 to 3 foot holes. Wait a minute. 2 feet.
Yeah, 2x2. Okay.
2x2 and a couple feet deep. In my South Davis backyard, I have tried filling with the planting mix I use for new plants. These holes are the result of failed plants. However, the surrounding soil is so rock hard that these filled holes are like quicksand, causing anyone walking back there to scream and clutch their balance. Do you have any idea for how to make these plant holes more stable? Do you sell topsoil or a dense soil or something? Do you have any ideas for plants to fill these holes?
Okay.
So let's just back off and make sure we got this understanding. You've got normal soil, you dug a hole in it, and remove the normal soil, then you put this other stuff in, and you planted in a plant, and the plant died. Now you've taken out the plant,
hopefully.
And so you've got a ground with has these divots of odd soil.
of a soil that's loose, and so people are, walking across and stumbling into it. First of all, South Davis soils are some of the best agricultural soil on the planet. Reef sandy loam, fine sandy loam, is what most of South Davis is, all the way down to, east of Dixon. And it's some of the, it's a wonderful drainage. Water penetrates it well, good infiltration rate. It's not a clay soil at all. It's a sandy or silty loam. So it's great soil. The concern I have here, and I don't know who gave the advice, this is why I want to make sure they understand I'm not criticizing anyone specifically for this. You do not fill planting holes with anything other than your native soil. So the first mistake was digging holes and filling them with something else. We just don't do that. It's important for root development, for proper irrigation management, to have a consistent soil texture, and you don't want sharp soil texture changes. You don't want a loose soil adjacent to heavy soil. Roots will not penetrate. It creates a weird water zone that roots can't penetrate, and they stay in the bathtub. We call it the bathtub effect for that reason. They stay in the area that where the soil was put in or turned in. We don't even turn in other stuff for woody plants. And I've got to say this, the research on this went back to the 1940s. This was standard instruction in horticulture classes in the 1970s, that you don't amend planting holes for trees or shrubs. You simply don't do it. And the studies were very clear. I mean, they would do things like dig holes, plant trees, dig them up several years later and see what the roots had done. Seems like a lot of trees got killed in this process. But and the results were very, very clear. And in some cases, the tops had given great growth, but the roots were not developing properly. Well, part they isolated that out by testing for soil amendment, nitrogen, and control of nothing. And the nitrogen is what gave you better top growth. So if they were turning stuff in that had manure or fertilizer added, yeah, you got better top growth. So from a nursery standpoint, turn this in, as we were all told to tell people in the 1970s, turn this into your soil. Every plant benefits from it. Well, what they're benefiting from, if you consider top growth to be a benefit, is the nitrogen content, the fertilizer part of it, not the compost part. Digging up and looking at the root systems and evaluating the extent of the roots and their ability to expand into the surrounding soil, it was very clear that there were not, it wasn't just not advantageous to amend the soil or backfill the hole. It was disadvantageous. It was harmful to the plant. In the case of a tree, this concerns us. You know, if a tree is putting on vigorous top growth and not developing a good anchor, well-anchored root system, that could be a problem down the road. It'll blow over, yes. Because yeah. Now, many roots do eventually find their way through and out. So ultimately, this problem may correct itself. One of the things you run into is maybe a lot of landscapers saying, well, my father always did it this way and got great results. Well, that's true. That's anecdotal, but it's, you know, it's possibly true. But you can't see what's going on with roots. You have to dig up the plant to see what's going on with the roots. So that's the first issue right there.
Well, and then they were saying that the soil around it was rock hard.
Yeah, that's
the next. It can only be rock hard if it is totally dry. So right. I'm wondering if maybe they weren't actually watering the ground. Maybe they were just watering the bathtub.
Right. Well, that's exactly what they were doing. If you've got sandy loam that's rock hard, it is because it's dry. There's no question about that. And as you irrigate new plants, it's important to provide water to where the roots would grow.
Yes.
So as we mentioned here frequently, irrespective of the amendment part of all this, the roots need to grow into soil with moisture. You don't have to water the surrounding soil as often as you do the newly planted zone, but you need to water it some every 10 to 14 days, a real thorough soaking. You know, we talk about that all the time. The need to bring all the soil in the root potential zone, potential root zone, let me say that correctly, to field capacity every now and then so that there'll be moisture in there when roots try to push into that area. So that's a big part of the problem right there, is it is rock hard because it was dry. So they were irrigating new plants in a little zone. It's not surprising those struggled and failed. That's very challenging to maintain the irrigation, essentially on what amounts to a container. Roots cannot grow into dry soil. So periodically irrigating the entire zone is important.
So what does she do now to fix this? I mean, if it was mine, I'd dig up all that loose stuff and dump the edge.
That's exactly what you need to do. And this is, so it's a big job because they've dug a bunch of holes and filled them with something. What I would do if it were mine is dig out as much of that planting mix as you possibly can, spread it out somewhere else. It can be on the surface. It's not like it's a contaminant. It's not like it's poisonous to the plants. It just creates this zone of poor root growth. So dig it out, spread it out somewhere else. Hopefully the soil that was originally dug out of that hole is somewhere else on the property and can be brought back in. If not,
just knock the edges in and
right. That's, yes, lower. to some degree, you can take a, soak everything down or wait till we've had an inch or two of rain. Might be easier at this point. Take a pickaxe and a shovel, a combination of those things, once it's a little softer, break up the soil around the low part, pull some soil in. Be sure to grade things out. If people are actually walking through that area, you may find this is a case where you will want to do some rototilling or turning just to level the soil out if there is actually a path through this area. But the best thing would be to get it back to the native soil as much as possible. Water the whole area thoroughly before you try to do any new plantings. As I say, an inch or two of rainfall, which we usually have here by mid-November, would be fine. Watering now would allow you to start planting this month. And the question was about, what are plants that will fill these holes? That'll be easy once you have it settled. But if you're going to have a bunch of divots with sandy or fast-draining soil perched here and there around the yard, I don't have an easy answer on that one, because any plant you put in is going to struggle to make that connection again. If I purchased a yard with this problem and I didn't have the labor in order to change the whole thing, I would just start planting cover crops. I would just plant, I'd probably do my favorite these days, which is a combination of oats and Dundale peas, because it's very vigorous. The roots will help to interconnect the soil types, the differing soil types to some degree. You chop it down, let it mulch its way in the spring. That would help to some degree. There's no easy way to fix this problem. One thing I thought of before we went on the air is, if you got a little sandy spot, throw some California poppy seeds right there before rainy season.
Not if it's a pot,
Well, here's the thing. We're going into the rainy season, the cool season. Most of the problems that we see with root rot or crown rot are due to the warm temperature pathogens like Phytophthora, which attack because water is collecting in that funny little basin they've created. Well, once everything is saturated in the winter and the temperatures are lower, Phytophthora is simply not going to be active. You're not going to have that problem. And poppies are kind of taprooted, actually. So planting things that'll grow through this weird soil into the native soil below, hopefully, would be one possibility. At worst, you'll have a bunch of spots of California poppies out in your backyard, which would be kind of pretty. And there's other flowers that would work as well that you could scatter now. So if you want a really simple thing to do, maybe to start seeding some wildflowers or some cool season annuals into those areas. One thing that would cause people to walk around them and not step in them and lose their balance. So it may not be the look you're after, but that's one thing you could do temporarily to try and ameliorate this problem. Here at KDRT, we're celebrating 21 years of grassroots radio, 21 years that would not be possible without the support of listeners like you. One of the best ways to keep KDRT's grassroots growing strong is by supporting us during our fundraiser. Make a $75 donation now and receive a special thank you gift, our new 21st birthday t-shirt. Just visit kdrt.org/donate for details.
Okay. Oak Woodlands Native. Is it okay to grow in Davis? This is a Holodiscus discolor, commonly known as ocean spray or cream bush or ironwood, whatever. And it's a shrub of Western North America.
Mm-hmm.
Will it grow in Davis?
Sure.
I have a light shade situation.
So you started with Oak Woodland. Oak Woodland is a plant community that's about 40, 50 miles from us to the west, if we want to go to the nearest version of it. Many of the poppy...
Slightly uphill, right?
Uphill, yes. Under the oaks. The woodlands that are under the oaks, uphill.
Okay.
So if you're going up to Lake Berryessa, for example, there's Oak Woodland plant community. And on the other side of the Coast Range, you have a whole lot of interesting choices there. It's interesting. Most of the popular California native plants that I can think of for Northern California come from either that plant community or further into Southern California in the coastal chaparral, the ceanothus, the manzanitas, the fremontodendrons down there, toyon, coffee berry, yes, but coyote bush. They're not native here on the valley floor, but they are native not too far away. I actually had a coyote bush come up on my farm all of its own accord, so I'm not that far from where they would be native. Yes, they will grow here, but it's important with each of these plants to look them up at calscape.org and see where they usually actually are from in that plant community. Are they on the dry slopes facing east, or are they on the moister slopes facing west? Do they grow near the moist channels or on the dry outcroppings? Because there are, even within that range, there's some variability. If you drive from Davis to the coast, you go through several plant communities. The oak woodland plant community is probably one of them. We need to look up the individual plant, see where within that it grows. And holodiscus appears to be from more shaded areas with more moisture. So it'll grow here, but don't treat it like a low water ceanothus. Put it in part of your yard that actually gets irrigated would be my suggestion on that one. We're always experimenting a little bit with these California native plants from other plant communities. Some of them, as we've mentioned, many times, and we're about to get into this season again at our nursery, ceanothus, manzanitas, flannel bush, the Fremontodendron. Not real happy here in the valley for the most part. They're easy to water too often. It's easy to kill them. Extreme heat is not something they're actually accustomed to. So they can be a challenge. But plants from the oak woodland plant community and that environment tend to be more adaptable. They tend to be plants with higher summer moisture tolerance. So I would guess a holodiscus would probably work for you, but it's a bit of an experiment. It's a big group of plants in that particular plant community. If you're looking for an excellent resource on this, Los Pilitas website, lospilitas.com, P-I-L-I-T-A-S, lospilitas.com. has for years now been a very, very good resource on what are the plants in a particular plant community. And it's a nursery, so it's focusing on the ones that you might actually be able to purchase and plant. And it gives great information about the different plant communities. And then for each individual plant, we just, before the show, head over to calscape.org, look this one up, say, yes, this sure looks like it would do well in partial shade in your yard, but probably would benefit from summer irrigation. As opposed to some that would be harmed.
That's exactly what it's like.
There's others that would be harmed by summer irrigation. So this is one that will probably fit in with your landscaping very well. That's one of the great benefits of the CalScape site that the California Native Plant Society has put together, is you can get a little more information about a plant and you can make an educated guess about how likely it is to succeed for you here.
So Don sometimes sends me pictures. And today he sent me the strange... My response to this was, oh, what?
What happened to that pepper?
Have you ever seen a Charmée puppy? They have so many wrinkles and stuff. They're so ugly. They're cute. Well, these guys are so ugly. They're ugly.
This is a glowing red pepper. Well, this is a Carolina Reaper pepper. At the time it was introduced 12, 15 years ago, it was described as the hottest hot pepper in the world, Carolina Reaper, as in the Grim Reaper. And it's in the million plus Scoville units category. That is to say, this is a dangerous pepper. If you have it in your garden, everybody in your household needs to be aware of this. I had a funny idea back in the early summer that maybe we could grow some peppers for holiday gift items. And so I took a few peppers home of two types. One was the little Thai pepper. It's a small Thai pepper, and I shifted them up into 8-inch pots in our richest soil, and they turned into these really cute little plants about one by one, and each one has, I'm looking out the window, about 50 tiny, bright red, extremely hot fruit on it. I say extremely hot, still a fairly normal person could ingest a part of that and go, oh, that's really hot, but they wouldn't be screaming. And they look like they have great potential.
They'd be sweating, though.
Yeah,
they'd be sweating.
Oh, they'd be reacting. Thai peppers are definitely hot, but they're not in the insanely hot category. And then I thought I was grabbing some habanero peppers, which is very, very hot. I mean, 800,000 Scoville units or something like that. Most people touching a habanero to their tongue would scream the first time, but might eventually get used to it. And to their, one advantage, habanero actually has a cool flavor once you get past the heat. Well, once the fruit started forming, the flavor of habanero is very fruity and it really is very
good. But it's not cool. It's hot.
No, definitely not cool. No, if you don't like hot peppers at all, you're definitely not going to eat a habanero. This is, let's say, I don't know, 100 plus times hotter than a jalapeno pepper or somewhere in that range. Well, then there's the super hot category. And I thought I had grabbed some habaneros, but it turned out I had actually inadvertently grabbed several Carolina Reaper. They're making very attractive.
There's that labeling plants. Problem again.
Yeah, well, they were labeled. This was a lack of attention problem. Operator error, that's me. But I went ahead and just so you know, if you want to grow these hot peppers yourself just to try them, I put them in 10-inch square pot sometime in about early July in the richest soil we sell, that really high-end potting soil. And in that time, they've grown to be about 2 feet tall. They've branched nicely. They have lots of flowers on them right now. They have 10 or 12 peppers setting right now, and a couple peppers that set early on. So if you've always wanted to grow the super hot peppers, but you don't know if it's something you would ever actually use, if you just want to see what they look like, this might be the way to do it. It's about the equivalent of a little less than a 5 gallon container. They've needed daily watering all through the summer. No question about that. The soil I used was enriched, so I haven't had to fertilize them. I noticed some of the older leaves are beginning to yellow a little bit, so I might go ahead and give them one light feeding with fish emulsion or something like that. And each one of these is going to produce, it looks like, about 8 to 10 of this insanely hot pepper, none of which I plan to use. I can assure you, I don't do this kind of thing. I'm not crazy. But there are people out there who are into this sort of, what?
And these are dangerous. I mean, if you have a little kid who goes and grabs this stuff and then touches their face, this is dangerous.
Yes,
stuff.
You need to understand that many hot peppers are hot enough that if you touch them and you get the oil and the stuff on your finger and then you touch your face, you will have a very unpleasant experience. So if you're growing these things, it's very important that they be labeled or maybe even put a little tomato cage around them and a little sign on it or something, because they're very, very, very hot. And just grabbing it to pick it could have some unfortunate consequences. I always want to tell people that when they're buying very hot peppers, anything from habanero up to the Carolina Reapers. And there's several others that have come on the market that are even hotter than Carolina Reaper at this point. But if you've always been curious about them, the way to do these, in my opinion, is in a large container to grow them, see them, sample them, see if it's something you would ever actually use. You probably, in your wide range of acquaintances and friends, have that one person, that one guy, who likes super hot peppers. I have two that I can think of that I'll give these to with no problem. They dry them. They use them all the time. Their average dinner is at an incendiary level that none of us could tolerate, but they're fine with that. You can learn, if you are not allergic to them or something, you can learn to tolerate hotter and hotter peppers. And these are folks who are quite used to very hot peppers. But I was surprised how well Carolina Reaper grew in a relatively small container without too much difficulty. They do need daily watering in this situation. It also gives you more control over where the plant is and who has access to it. So if you've always wondered about growing the Reapers or the Trinidad Scorpion or the Butjolokia, which is called ghost pepper, these are the very, 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 very hot peppers. Might do it in a container first, and it does work. They do work in a reasonable size container, 3 to 5 gallon container in rich soil. Put it where it'll be easy to water it every day in the summer. The Thai pepper, great potential. I'm thinking we're just going to phase out poinsettias and have Thai peppers for the holidays. Cute little red fruit on a green leaf plant. You know, we've got the holiday colors. And yes, you can eat them and you won't be screaming on your way to the hospital.
I wanted to ask you about regrowth. So I have a cotoneaster and it's sitting out by the sidewalk and it's now overshadowed by lots of other things. But all I can see are the stems. All the leaves are up higher. I want it to be more of a screen than that. Mm-hmm. So I just went 7 feet up and whacked it. And so
Cut
it all.
Okay.
And the stems, there's multiple stems, are about as big as two fingers put together. So it's not small, but it's not a giant tree-like thing. So here's my question. If I cut that down, I'm assuming that a cotoneaster is going to have buds that will break and regrow. When you take off the top part, and obviously there's no chemicals suppressing the buds further down.
Well, you've taken all that hormone suppression away, yes.
Yeah. So is it going to break buds all the way down the trunk, or is it just going to break them at the ring where you cut it? What happens with buds in cotoneaster?
Well, you've taken away the hormones. Any of the buds further down on the plant can sprout. Cotoneasters are very popular for hedges because they do have a lot of regrowth buds. Many of our popular hedge plants are used for that purpose, that you can clip them, shear them, thin them, head them, whatever you want to do, and almost invariably they'll resprout from somewhere. I guarantee if you took a chance on cut that cotoneaster to the ground, there's a very high likelihood it would resprout from the stump because there's lots and lots of growth buds. Other plants, important to note, those growth buds fade over time. So junipers, for example, decided to prune the junipers in the center divider right in front of where our nursery is last summer in the middle of July during a heat wave. And they're all dying now because you shouldn't do that. I'm not surprised that they're dying. I'm a little surprised that a reputable landscape service would do that. They don't have growth buds that are ready to sprout, and they certainly wouldn't be inclined to do it in the middle of a heat wave. So some plants like boxwood, cotonia aster, privets, even yews, others, if you cut them back, there's going to be growth buds down there that will sprout pretty much all the way down, capable of doing so. Where they exactly do probably depends on how much sunlight strikes them at this point. So if whether or not you open it up enough to get sun all the way down to the ground, or whether
there's
it's
no
just,
sun.
Yeah, so it'll probably be higher up on the plant, but it could be rather arbitrary. The hormone, you've disrupted the hormone flow, so almost any of those buds are capable of sprouting and growing. There's two ways to do an old overgrown plant like that. One that landscape services are likely to want to do for you when they come in, and you say this is really overgrown, they're going to want to cut it back really hard. That's fine. For some plants, it works great. Pittosporum tobira, I guarantee it'll be back. Privets, definitely. They'll come back very bushy, and you're just essentially starting over the whole process of getting it back up to size. I'm looking out the window at a Pittosporum tobira variegata that I planted 30 years ago, kept it at 5 feet for many years, allowed it at one point when we needed more shade on the window to grow up to about 15 feet. And then we no longer need the shade, so I cut it back to 5 feet, and it's resprouted fine. It seems to be tolerant of anything I wish to do to it. Some plants will do that. Most cotonia asters will do that. If you want to be more aesthetic about it, you can thin the plant, remove crossing branches, open it up, drop down some of those taller branches, get more light, even if it's not direct sunlight, into the interior of the plant. Some buds further down will sprout and grow more at eye level. When that's happened, you can then, a year later, take the rest of the plant down to that point, and you won't be as disturbed by the extreme change that has been made as you might be if you took it down to the ground all at once. So you need to know the plant. You need to know whether it has growth buds ready to go in the case of pruning like that. No on junipers. Yes, on cotonia aster, pittosporum, privet, boxwood, and then plan accordingly for what you can tolerate. In many cases, cutting it back very, very, very hard might be a good way to renew it and start over. More commonly, people want to still have some semblance of privacy, so they do it as a two-step process.
So our garden quote for today is from Beverly Nichols, who said, "The great majority of the flowers in my garden are in their present places because they have personally informed me in the clearest possible tones that this is where they want to be."
Happenstance and serendipity are very important parts of gardening.
So it's the end of the show, but it is not the end of KDRT. If you want to keep us happening, keep us going, keep all these programs on the air, please go to kdrt.org, send us a donation.
You've been listening to Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Hi, this is Don Shore. I host Jazz After Dark. Lois Richter and I host the Davis Garden Show. Lois has her own show called That's Life. And those are just three of over 30 locally produced programs here at KDRT coming to you every week. If you like eclectic music, great public affairs programming, just like the idea of local grassroots radio, please consider a donation during our birthday fun drive this week. Our little radio station runs on volunteer work, a small hardworking staff, and your donations. Head on over to kdrt.org and click on the donate button. We appreciate donations at any level, whatever you can give. You can make a one-time gift now or consider a monthly donation, which helps us plan throughout the year. Regardless of amount, monthly donations add up and keep us growing. Just visit kdrt.org/donate.